your work life, all of our work lives. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Hopefully not too much later in the show, we will talk with Elizabeth George, one of perhaps the most respected and best-selling novelists today, about what it's really like to be a novelist. But she, although we confirmed, she's not at the phone number she said she would be. So it will proceed onward. And fortunately, this was one of those rare times I was going to jointly interview, or at least have somebody else ask a question or two, because Elizabeth George happens to be my wife, Barbara Nemko's favorite author. And so I wanted to give Barbara a chance to ask a few questions. But she's not there. So, Barb, first of all, we were going to do a something else in segment two. We're just going to do that first. So, Barbara, first, welcome to the show. Glad you're here, of course.
Thank you so much.
So, there is a technique that I call the joint story. It has nothing to do with marijuana. That can help clients get a have a better vision for what they would like their life to look like in the near and long term. In a way that if I simply ask them directly, they might not. I mean, we all know that child therapists use puppet therapy to get kids to be more candid about things and more, maybe more, more just more self-revealing by using a puppet instead of themselves as the vehicle for the story. And that's the basis on this concept. And it's very deceptively simple. I simply tell the client, or dear listener, you can simply pretend you're talking with your twin and having this back and forth between your twin. You simply say, we are going to jointly create a story. So I'm going to start, Barbara and I, we're going to do it for you here and therefore demonstrate and probably invite the callers to call in, and we'll at least do one on a caller, and we'll demonstrate it with somebody else. Now, again, it's hard for listeners to believe me. Barbara and I have not practiced at all. We have not discussed this at all. I only told her basically in a sentence what we were going to do. So this is going to be really kind of radio verite, the way it would be as if a counselor were doing this with a student. Is it, first of all, with a client? Am I being completely honest here, Barb?
Absolutely. In fact, before we get to verite, what is the role of the person who's adding to the story? Is it supposed to be like a story of the way I wish my life had turned out?
Nope, it's not you at all.
So I make different choices?
Nope.
You'll see.
Okay, so I'll just start.
I'll see. So I have no further instructions.
No further instructions.
Make up anything that comes into my head.
That's right. Once there was a woman in her 50s who was successful but miserable. And
she said, I don't want to be miserable for the rest of my life, so perhaps I should pursue a different kind of life.
And so she
decided that she always wanted to be a lawyer, and she would try to go to law school.
And so she applied to a bunch of law schools, and, you know, even though she was successful, being in her 50s, you know, we say there is an age discrimination in the higher education, but there is, and she got rejected from everyone except for a small, unaccredited law school, but that nonetheless had some real master practitioners. And so she decided to enroll because she didn't care so much about being hired by a big law firm, just wanted to pass the bar. And
what she really wanted to do was go into law that dealt with people who were getting divorced so that things could be worked out and nobody would be terribly traumatized, especially the children. So
She tailored, because it was an unaccredited law school, there was actually more flexibility, and she tailored her law school experience to focus on exactly that, helping couples to separate amicably and especially on behalf of the children, so the children didn't get ruined in the divorce. And then after she graduated, she was delighted that she'd actually made a graduation, and her family and friends all showed up and clapped big and loud for her, and then
she had to find a job. But because she came from an unaccredited law school, big firms were not anxious to hire her.
And so she figured she had, after, nor were the little firms, because they were really afraid of all this. So although she passed the bar, she felt she had no choice but to hang out her own shingle. And?
And she started with telling everybody she knew that this is what she was doing. And that she was licensed, and so she could do this work. And it took a couple of months, and she was getting very discouraged.
And then finally, one friend, more out of sympathy than anything else, her friend was getting divorced, but was really scared to trust her divorce to this unaccredited law school to be her first client. But
it was her friend, and she figured she could have a lot of input into what was going on. And so she found her friend to be very sympathetic and very common sense oriented. So she was feeling like it didn't really matter that she didn't have a fancy law degree from a fancy school.
And she didn't charge very much because it was the first client, and this woman was quite ethical. And so she charged a rate that was probably less than half of what a lawyer would do in exchange for, if the client was happy or a friend was happy, that she would offer a good reference. And in fact, it worked. The divorce, well, no one could say it was amicable. It was always stressful arguments. But it was better than many of the long 5-year drawn-out nightmares that so many divorces tend to be. And then after that success, our hero...
She decided that, having done this, she wanted to talk to other people who did similar kinds of law. And so she registered to go to a law conference, and she went to a session where somebody was talking about divorce law, and she volunteered some information on what she had done in this one case. And a few people said that they had clients who were a pain in the neck, and they didn't want to deal with them. They'd be happy to refer them to her.
Yep, and so they did, especially during the holidays. She realized that in the beginning she had to make sacrifices. So sometimes the divorces, the crap was hitting the fan during the Christmas holidays, which is a stressful time for many couples. And yet she was willing to take on these clients who were in crisis even during the Christmas holidays. And that is how she ended up building a practice. And little by little, she was in excellent health, and she stayed doing it for over 25 years. And then at 82, she
decided maybe she would retire because it was getting harder to see and hear. And so, and she had some health issues and decided she didn't need the stress anymore. But to keep herself from feeling like she was totally over the hill, she contacted some people that she had met over the years and who were teaching in various law schools and asked if she could come in and give the occasional guest lecture on divorce law.
So she did those guest lectures, but even that didn't fill up much time. So she did volunteer, and she did pro bono work counseling low-income people who were also divorcing. She also developed a whole lot of activities having nothing to do with the law, for example.
She joined a current events club, and then she joined a yoga group and a movie going to club, and she found that she didn't really need much more than that. She had family and friends that she saw too, and she felt like it had been a life well led.
And at age 95, she's now lying in her deathbed. And she's reviewing her life and thinking, and she thought,
I should have done that 15 years before I did. There was no reason to be in a job I didn't really like until I was 50.
Okay. So that ends that story. Now, tell me your experience as the client. What was your experience in doing that exercise? Did you gain anything out of it? Was it yucky? Tell me your honest experience of it.
Well, that's the kind of thing, it's not my favorite. But what I did find happening is you have to draw on your own life, because you can't suddenly sit and make up things that you've never thought about.
Exactly.
So when I had to do something with this woman at 50, I don't know what somebody who was 50 who didn't like their job would do, but I do remember when I was in my 40s thinking, I'm not sure if this is all there is, and maybe I do want to go to law school. And so that's why the story took that direction. And, of course, I did not go to law school.
Right. Did you get any – if you were indeed my client, would you have drawn any insights about what you might actually want to do in the future from playing creating that mock joint story?
Well, I think I learned some – I don't know if I learned them or I knew them. That's why I said them. But the idea of – reaching out through friends, doing guest lectures in other people's classes, the things I would do when I ever retired and got old, those are all things that I had some experience with. Other people might take up bungee jumping, but that didn't come into my mind as an activity.
So is it fair to say at minimum it crystallized some thoughts that were rolling around in your brain, and at minimum you got to actively think it through and therefore got at least in that mere 3 minutes of an exercise got a measure of clarity about what your long-term life plan might be?
Yes, and I think it also would, if I were talking to a counselor, it would give us lots of entry points for discussion about different things.
Precisely. And dear listeners, of course, not everybody's going to see a counselor. So, but it's an excellent idea to play with your alter ego, with your twin. Start out by saying, by describing somebody who isn't precisely like you, but let's say you're a man in your 30s who's working for government. You say, there was a guy in his 40s who was working in the nonprofit sector, and then go back and have your alter ego, your twin, continue the story for a few sentences until he runs out of what to say, and continue. It always ends up with you on your deathbed at 95. And that can often provide some insights in a very fun and effortless way to help you get unstuck. In any case, it is my pleasure that the promised guest indeed is on the line. Think about it. Being able to make a living as a novelist, it remains a dream for many people, but a dream come true for just a relative few. Well, someone who has defied the odds is Elizabeth George. She is a New York Times bestselling author of 20 books, which have been translated into 30 languages, and a majority of them have been adapted for television by the BBC. Her work is, she's not a potboiler kind of person who's just doing some old-fashioned Agatha Christie stuff. Her work has been honored by the Agatha Awards, the Anthony Awards, the Grand Prix de Littérature Policière, and the MIMI, which is Germany's prestigious prize for suspense fiction. And lest you think that by book 20 she is burning out, Booklist, which is the American Library Association's book review publication, said that her latest book, The Punishment She Deserves, just out in paperback, quote, shows the author at the peak of her powers. Elizabeth George, welcome to Work with Marty Nemko.
Oh, thank you so much, and I apologize for being a little bit late.
We're all human. We all do stuff like that, even famous, eminent people. So, but let's start, before we get to talking about writing and the writing career, tell me, I noticed that your promo picture has you holding your little doggy. Would you care to tell me about your doggy? Because I am a doggy person, too.
Oh, my doggy is a wire-haired dachshund, mm-hmm. and she is now almost 15 years old.
Wow.
She is, her name is Lucy, mm-hmm. and she accompanies me every day to work and has
uh-huh.
her entire life.
Uh-huh.
Now she's at the point that she goes out for stroller walks rather than
yes.
actual, you know, feet on the ground walks.
It's so hard to see. It's so hard to see them decline, isn't it?
Yeah, you know, it is, but she's actually doing pretty well, to tell you the truth. She's had 2 surgeries on her back and has come through both of them, so she's really great.
Yeah.
Touch wood. I hope she lives to be 25.
Of course, we all do. My doggie's going to be 13. He's a little bigger than yours, so his life expectancy isn't as good. Why did you name her Lucy?
You know, I can't even remember. I think that my husband and I just wanted to call a dog Lucy. I think, and I know what it was, our original idea was we wanted a wire-haired dog, and we were going to call her Lulu. But when she came out of the little container, we just saw a Lucy instead of a Lulu. So we call her Lucy Bean, the drama queen.
I see. Well, now I should be good and grow up and not talk about dogs. The show's supposed to be about work, so I'll be good. We'll start chronologically. Were there early signs that you would become a successful writer?
Oh, sure. When I was, I wouldn't say successful. Let's just take the successful part out. There were signs that I would be a writer. And for me, I always had really modest expectations. So although, I wrote three books, three crime novels to get published, and the one that got published was really well received and won some awards. But so I knew that I could continue to write them. I could support myself as a writer. And that was my big thing right from the beginning, is to be able to support myself as a writer.
What I meant by early, I meant as a child. Were there signs?
Oh, yeah.
Tell me.
Oh, there were definitely signs that I was going to be a writer, because I started writing short stories when I was really little, probably about, well, I know it was probably when I was in second grade. Huh. And I always wrote stories that were about the kind of life I wanted to have, if that makes any sense.
Hmm.
I grew up in Mountain View, California, and I had a very small nuclear family, and my extended family was in everywhere from Kansas all the way to the eastern seaboard. And in those days, people didn't travel as much, so I actually never saw them. So that idea of having a family, having a larger family, a larger extended family, really was reflected in my earliest stories. People always came from big families.
And, you wrote in one of your previous interviews, you talked about having a fascination with the aberrant personality, and not just the actions of what they did, but the why they do what they did, and what are the internal reactions of the victims. Where did that start? It's just an intrinsic, voyeuristic interest, or beyond that?
I can't really tell you if there was a particular incident that started it. I don't think there was. I think that I just had this natural curiosity about people and why people do what they do. And I do remember, as a very young child, reading crime stories both in the newspaper and in Life magazine. I remember reading, about the Boston Strangler. Mm. I certainly remember reading about Sam Shepard and the murder of his wife. I mean, I can still, I can close my eyes and I can still see the illustration they used showing the footprints around the house and stuff. And it just, for some reason, caught my interest. It really fascinated me.
Yeah, it's certainly the opposite of the mundane. Most people live mundane lives, and the aberrant, whether it be, there's something about, either the elite life of the Kim Kardashians that attracts people, or on the other end of the continuum, the people who are either socioeconomically or in terms of crime at the bottom end, and I guess that's going to be more interesting than the average. Is that a fair assertion?
Sure, and it's the same thing that you could apply to somebody who's really an elite athlete, and what they go through to achieve the status that they end up with. That is equally interesting to me as why somebody would murder someone. It's that whole thing of what people go through to be who they are, to become who they are, and to live the kinds of lives that they live.
And so for you right now, I'm jumping ahead. We'll get back to the books and everything. We're all striving to live as richly as we can. You've now finished 20 books. I imagine you're working on 21. What are you striving for right now, either in your writing or in your life?
Well, when it comes to my writing, I am always attempting to make each book a leap ahead, better than the last book. And that has been my focus for my entire career, not to write the same novel over and over. And that continues to be something that I strive for.
Can you be specific? Can you give me, without giving away details that you don't want to give away, what's your stretch? What are you stretching to do in novel 21 that you haven't done in novels 1 through 20?
It would mostly, I think, be in the area of improvement. I would, I'm always looking to improve my ability to have a setting that resonates for the reader. I always try to make my characters as real as they can possibly be as human beings. I try to come up with stories that reflect what's, you know, the issues that people face. You know, for example, in The Punishment She Deserves, without giving away what's going on, there's a contemporary issue at the heart of the crime in the novel. And it's something that we have seen and read about a lot in the United States. Mm-hmm, mm-hmm. And I wanted to make that the sort of what I would call the backdrop. There's sort of an undercurrent. In one of my novels, for example, the undercurrent was the Anglo-Pakistani experience in Great Britain as it concerns mm-hmm. arranged marriages, mm-hmm. and that was sort of what I was looking at. So what I try to do is to make books, you know, current at the same time as they expose the readers to, you know, real characters at the same time as they move the story of my continuing characters forward.
I got to tell you that, you know, I read The Punishment She Deserves, and my favorite character and the example, I don't know if it's been timely for thousands of years, but my favorite character and my favorite thing within the character was Elizabeth Ardrey, as she rationalizes her way into becoming an alcoholic. That felt like really revelatory. That felt like a deep character. It was a window into the way in which alcoholics get formed. Tell me a little bit more about that character in that book.
Well, she is a character who appeared the very first time in a book called Playing for the Ashes. And I always create my characters in advance if they're stepping onto the page. So I was intrigued by that character in that book. She was the investigating officer for an arson. And when I had an opportunity to bring her back in a book called This Body of Death, I had this opening for it, and I thought, oh, this is the perfect time, you know, to bring back that character, because I needed somebody to step into the detective chief superintendent's position. Mm-hmm. So she was the character that I chose to bring back to do that. And I was aware of her, you know, it becomes clear early on that she has a problem with alcohol as the reader first meets her. And I really understood that to make her a believable character, her story had to continue, which meant that she was either going to, you know, climb out of this pit or sink into the pit and never emerge from it. So essentially, when I got into the book, I realized that this could be the vehicle where Isabel has to confront her alcoholism, and indeed that's what she does in the book.
Plot is one thing, you know, you're describing the plot rationalizations, but you have in one of the previous interviews said you're much more interested in being a character-driven writer, which I prefer myself. You know, I really felt, you just felt inch by inch how she was rationalizing a little more drink, and it's only just this minute. I need this to straighten up now, but I'll be fine. It made me feel like I understood that, you know, that process, which in some ways is a richer experience than any kind of plot development. You buy that analysis?
Oh yeah, I do, and I was highly complimented by one of my friends who's a recovering alcoholic, and she read it and said, "Oh yeah, that was it.
Good.
It was right on the money." So I was really pleased, because there's always that doubt that arises when a writer is writing something that is outside of her own personal experience, which is essentially what I do all the time. You know, they talk about writing what you know, and I've always written about what I don't know mm-hmm. and want to mm-hmm. consider.
Mm-hmm. Right, I can understand that. You know, my wife has wanted to ask you a question, and she's been waiting patiently. I'm going to want to let her get off the phone here, but this is as good a time as any. First of all, I should let our listeners know, you listen to Work with Marty Nemco and Barbara Nemco, who you will hear in a moment. I am talking about what it's really like to be a novelist with Elizabeth George, or, you know, certainly among the top. She balances being a quality writer. She's not a Pulp Fiction writer, but she also sells really really well. She is a New York Times bestselling author of 20 books, translated to 30 languages. Her most recent one is The Punishment She Deserves. Barbara Nemco, thank you for your patience. What is your question that you would like to ask Elizabeth George?
Well, thank you for the opportunity. Elizabeth, I absolutely love your books. I've been reading them since you've been writing them, and you are honestly the only author whose website I go to make sure you're really working on another new book.
Well, so, thank you.
And I love your characters, which is what brings me to my question. My very favorite and also, the book that I found most difficult to read was What Came Before He Shot Her, because it was such a deviation from anything you'd done before, and yet I thought it was the most powerful book that I had read on the topic of what happens to families who live under the stress of dire poverty. Mm-hmm. And I wondered, when you started writing the book in which you killed off Helen, not to put it to fine point, were you already killing off Helen because you knew you wanted to write this other book, or after you decided to kill her off, you thought, well, maybe there ought to be a story about how that all happened?
Originally, my intention was to make the story of what came before he shot her, to make that part of the book in which Helen is killed, and in that particular book, the book in which Helen is killed is a serial killer novel, and what I saw, the serial killer is killing young boys, and so when I got to that book that I was going to, the serial killer book, I realized I had a good vehicle. This sounds really very Machiavellian, but I had a good vehicle to kill off Helen, and so I figured that, oh, okay, I'm going to write a serial killer book, so the serial killer will kill Helen. But then I realized, oh my gosh, anybody would do that. That's stupid. I can't do that. Somebody else has to kill Helen, and Linley has to reach the conclusion that it is a serial killer. Because of things that have happened in the book. So what I figured is that the reader reading about this young boy, Joel, would assume that he was being set up to be one of the victims of the serial killer. But that was going to make the book huge. I mean, it was a big book anyway, but that was going to bring the book in at about 1,500 pages. So I thought, I can't do that. So what I'll do is I'll just tell Joel's story in the next book. So it wasn't that I wanted to tell the Joel story and had to come up with who the person was that he killed. It was more that I always intended to write that story too. I just didn't know I was going to end up doing it in this separate book.
Okay, Barbara, I want to thank you very much for your patience, and I will talk to you after the show.
Okay, thank you.
All right, take care. I want to step back a little bit, and talk about the process of developing a novel. That's kind of what this show is supposed to focus on, is what the career is like, what the work is like. Your plots are very intricate. Your settings are very detail oriented. I know you go to all your stuff is set in England, and you go there because it's better than looking it up on the internet. It's a rather labyrinthine process. Where do you generally begin?
Sometimes I begin knowing that I'm going to write a book about X, whatever X is. For example, I knew I wanted to write a book about the Anglo-Pakistani community and arranged marriages. So I knew that was my jumping off point. Mm-hmm. But often it has to do with place. There's a place in England that I think might work to set a novel in. And so I go and explore that place, and the place helps me generate an idea. So I would say most often it's the combination of place and sort of idea at a granular level that set me off on the path to writing a novel.
I know that many writers struggle with discipline, or would-be writers is probably a fairer statement. You've written 20 books, but it's possible that even so you may struggle with discipline. Do you? And if so, how do you stay disciplined enough?
Oh, it's a disappointing answer I have to give you. I have always had a tremendous amount of self-discipline, and I do not know why.
Yep.
I think I was born that way.
Yep.
I was a kid who did her homework as soon as she got home from school. You know, and it was, it's just, you know what it is that when I have something that I know I have to do,
mm-hmm.
I enjoy my life much more if I do that first and then do other stuff later. Some people can procrastinate and have a really great time and then all of a sudden realize, oh, I've got to get this whatever it is done. I was never that person. I can enjoy myself, but only if I've actually done what I need to do. So in a given day, one of the things that I must do is my writing. Now, that's also, though, the gift of it is that I really enjoy doing it as well. So it's not like I have to drag myself to the computer before I can, let's say, you know, go out and ride roller coasters at the nearest amusement park. It's not like that. I enjoy doing it. I really embrace that, the whole process of writing. So it's never a chore.
How much of it is, you know, let's say you weren't, are you that way with the things that are chores? Vacuuming, doing your taxes? Because you said you were disciplined even in school when maybe you didn't love all the subjects. Do you feel that, you said you were born that way. Do you feel you're just disciplined in general, or is it limited to things you love like the writing?
No, it's just that's the way it is in general.
Yep.
Now, when I was a high school teacher, I had my papers graded the next day. My students adored me for that reason.
Right.
I was a tough teacher, but they knew. You know, if they wrote an essay, they knew exactly when they were going to get it back because I would tell them. And they never had to ask because if I said, I'll have the essays ready for you in 10 days, they knew that that's exactly what was going to happen.
I think in 2019, we still have no idea what differentiates, what is the root causal factor between procrastinators and not. Because there are some very talented writers who procrastinate and many mm-hmm. others who don't. And that's true of everything. And it has been, it's a very resistant to improvement. I think that 30 or 40 years from now, we will find that there is something neurological or hormonal or whatever in different people's brains that, I am like you. And yet I have so many clients who know they shouldn't procrastinate, who want to be a writer or whatever, know they should be looking for a job, and yet they just can't make themselves avoid the brinksmanship. Anyway, but
yeah, I think it's a real blessing to be a person who actually has self-discipline. Because otherwise, I don't know how one develops it unless it's, you know, sheer fear, you know, that they need to have a paycheck so they are going to have to go out and look for a job. I don't know.
There's a million techniques, everything from what I call the one-minute struggle. Normally, if you've struggled for a minute with something and you haven't made progress, you're generally not going to solve it, and so you either figure out a way to do the project without that, or you ask for help, or you come back and look at it later. That's one of a million techniques I have. And you know, in the end, they end up having only a modest... I've written a ton about procrastination. Each of these techniques, I got probably 50 of them, they help incrementally, but ultimately they will never do as much as what you naturally will do. But I digress. In any case, when you read, do you read the reader reviews on Amazon or the professional reviews of your book? And if so, does it inform your subsequent writing?
I don't read any reviews that are anonymous and I actually have. I didn't even know you could read reviews on Amazon. So obviously, I've never read reviews on Amazon, I haven't read any reviews on Goodreads or actually any other vehicle for non-professional reviews.
Mm.
In the old days of my being published, they used to have publishing houses used to have clipping services,
right.
And the clipping service would send out all the reviews. To the editor, and the editor then would forward them on. And in those days, I did read not all of the reviews, but some of the reviews. And but now, there is no clipping service, and I actually have no idea what I see is like the same quotes everybody else sees on the book cover.
Wow.
I think that my publicist may occasionally forward one on to me, but I even in the point where they were forwarding reviews to me, not via internet, but, you know, through the clipping service, I really never read them all because I just usually was working on another book, and I didn't either I didn't have time or I didn't want to clutter up my mind with what, you know, what somebody was saying about the book.
I'm just going to test something out here for the fun of it. I've read a good few of your books. I read The Grand Deliverance, and I've read the most recent one, The Punishment She Deserves. And I would, if I were to be writing a review, it would be, clearly your plotting is intricate and credible and interesting. Your settings are wonderful. Your writing quality, your language is literary but accessible, quite crystalline. I would say, if I were to make one suggestion, it would be that while you do have characters that are certainly not cardboard, I would challenge you in your next novels to go even deeper into the interiority of your characters. Now, that's a quarter review, right, which you were forced to listen to. Is your initial reaction defensiveness, good point, promising yourself you'll never listen to a review again? What's your reaction?
Oh, my initial reaction was, that's interesting. How would I do that? Basically. That was my knee-jerk reaction.
So my reaction to that would be, you would take your, obviously minor characters aren't that critical, but you would take your protagonist, your maybe two or three or four major characters, and you would write a psychographic sketch of them a priori, up front, before you wrote a word, before you did anything else, before you plotted. You would write a psychographic, biographical profile starting from when they were a little boy or girl, and their relationship with their parents, their genetics, their peer signature moments that affected them psychologically through their life, so that you started out with a very rich psychological picture of that person. And maybe to get you off on that, you would do your own, about your own personal life, so that you would see how many intricacies there really are about who you are. Now, is that the kind of presumption? How dare a radio talk show host tell the eminent Elizabeth George not only what to do but how to do it, or is there some legitimacy to it?
Well, I as you were saying that, I was picturing my writing students listening to it and yelling at their radios. That's what she does.
Okay.
I've been, since my third novel, I have been doing what I call a character analysis of every character who has a speaking role in the book. Somebody who's just, who walks in for one scene, I always give an agenda to, mm-hmm. but have not done a character analysis
right.
of. But for all of the other characters, before I write a word of the book itself, I've actually created all the characters. Only one character is created to do something specific, and that's the killer. The rest of the characters are created to be living, breathing human beings that reflect what William Faulkner said all characters should reflect and be human, heart, and conflict. So I don't really have the intricacies of their childhoods and things like that, but I do put myself in the position of being their psychologist, their counselor, their physician, their spiritual advisor, their biographer. And I analyze. I look at the character in all possible ways. I assign each character a core need, the one thing that's really driving their behavior that they're trying to have met. And then I assign to each character also a psychopathology. What do they do under stress when their core need isn't being met? So all of that is done in advance. But clearly, I mean, that's what you said is so interesting, because I'm thinking, oh, okay, well, looks like I need to do more than I'm already doing.
I am really one guy. Clearly your model is great. That's a one. I mean, I loved your answer. It's a very rich answer to any aspiring writer. It's a really deep character sketch. I love it. But yeah, I mean, maybe it's not what you do, and it may be you need to do nothing. I mean, clearly you have been you're an acclaimed author. But if I were to, if I were to suggest something, is to take a look at after you've written that profile, maybe to meditate it on a little bit and make sure it's suffused, that it's not a standalone exercise, but it truly, suffuses through each moment in your character's experience. Anyway, I don't want to stay on that. Anyway, I didn't give out the phone number because Barbara was on the line and our technology doesn't allow three people, but Barbara's hung up. So without my even giving out the phone number, there is somebody champing at the bit to talk to Elizabeth George. So welcome to Work with Marty Nemko. It is your turn on the air. What is your question or comment for Elizabeth George?
Is that me?
It is.
Oh, okay. Yes, I have read all of Elizabeth George's books except the new one. And my favorite is, I think it's called Finding Joseph.
Oh, Missing Joseph.
Pardon?
Missing Joseph.
Losing Joseph. Anyways, the couple of things that I wanted to say is that one book that you wrote a couple books back took place quite a bit in Italy. And mm-hmm. you wrote in Italian with no translation. Mm-hmm. And I was just, you know, I was thinking, I can't understand this. And so I was wondering why you did that.
I wrote it without any translation because my feeling was that what was going on in the scene was sufficient to show the reader what the conversation was about. You know, there was really never any lengthy conversation, but there was. I thought that there was enough that the reader wouldn't be totally confused by it.
Anyway,
but it sounds like you might have been.
Yeah, and the only other thing is that your books have gotten longer and longer, and this new one I can't even hold in my hands. So I'm not averse to reading books that are 400 and 500 pages, but when yours get up to 700 and 800 pages, I think, maybe you need another editor.
Well, anyway, thank you for the call. You can always get a Kindle. Why don't you,
I'm not going to get a Kindle.
Okay. All right. Anyway, thanks very much for the call. She mentioned your editors. Have you ever had a problem with any of your editors, Elizabeth George?
I never have. I've had wonderful editors.
Wow.
And they've always been incredibly supportive. I can remember my first editor. I was richly blessed to have Kate Misiak at Bantam Books. It was what was called Bantam at the time. It's now part of Random House, but she was my first editor, and those were in the days where they knew that publishers knew that it took some time to build a career, that you did not have to have a New York Times best-selling book as your first novel.
Right, right.
And she was wonderful. Whatever I wanted to do was just fine.
Wow.
I remember one time saying to her, Kate, in the book I'm doing right now, Lindley's not going to appear in it for, I don't know, maybe 50 or 60 pages. And her response, I'll never forget, her response was, well, if your reader is expecting to see Lindley on the first page of every novel or in the first chapter of every novel, your reader will have to adjust.
Yeah, very good.
And that's
good.
How it's been. That's how it's been all the way through.
For those listeners who don't know, Inspector Lindley was her original major protagonist. She made him an earl to give him a little, as actually a foil. She made him dislikable deliberately. You were trained to dislike rich people. So we made him rich, although he's not a cartoon character. He's got a good heart and an excellent mind, but he is a bit officious. And that the purpose of that character was to create a foil for the more likable character, Barbara Havers, who's slightly overweight and blue collar and has all the common sense in the world, who's being oppressed by the powers that be. Is that a fair summary?
Yeah, Barbara is working class. She is the polar opposite of Lindley. And what I wanted to do with these two characters, and it was my intention from the very beginning to write a book in which the reader could see that a man and a woman could come to absolutely love each other and have that love be not the least bit sexual. And mm-hmm. that's what I wanted to happen with these two characters. Mm-hmm. They completely
right.
love each other and completely have each other's back. But the idea in either of their heads that they would ever you know, have any romantic involvement is just, you know, they would be horrified. Both of them would be horrified.
Yeah, they're ultimately missing. They're perfect platonic, respectful colleagues of each other. I want to let our listeners, we're going to let you off the air in a minute, but you're listening to Work with Marty Nemco. I'm talking about what it's really like to be a novelist with one of today's best, Elizabeth George, the author of 20 books, including most recently, The Punishment She Deserves. Do you want to say much about number 21?
Well, the next book that's coming out is a book on writing itself, and it's called Mastering the Process from Idea to Novel, and that book will be out next year. And basically, what I really like about it is that it's a book that takes my process and shows the reader how someone, in this case myself, how someone actually puts together a novel from the idea of the moment the idea arrives to the actual sending it off and the copy editing is done. And this book takes just one of my novels, a novel called Careless in Red, and takes all the examples from it. And because I still have all of my materials that I used when I was writing Careless in Red, they become part of this book, Mastering the Process. So that's the next book that comes out. The 21st Linley novel is something that I am leaving for England to do research on at the end of this month.
Just because, you know, I'm a career counselor. I've had 12 books published myself, not only two are fiction, but I love playing these games. It's again a radio verite. Is there a question, as just a fellow author, it's presumptuous of me, you can say no. Is there a question that you would like to ask me that might be of any value as you are starting the research process for Linley Novel 21?
There certainly are questions I could ask you, especially considering what you've been talking about with characters, but I couldn't ask them without giving away the plot, unfortunately.
Okay, we'll let it go. Now, I have just two more questions. Do you have any sense of why most, not all, of course, of the most successful mystery writers, Dorothy Sayers, which is who I cut my teeth on, and Agatha Christie, who I find overrated and formulaic, P.D. James, Ruth Rendell, and you, are all women, and more specifically British women, or in your case, an American woman who sets all her novels in the U.K. Any sense of why that is?
You know, I don't really know. I tend to think that it might be because that was the field in which women had an entree in ways they didn't have into other areas of fiction. But I'm only saying that off the top of my head. The great crime writers in Great Britain have all been women. And my guess also is that where one woman is successful, another woman will follow too.
Okay. Do you ever, you know, you're not a kid anymore. You know, you've written all these books over a long period of time. You know, you were talking about the age where there was clipping services. Do you envision?
I know, really.
Yeah, right. Do you envision a time that you'll stop writing?
Sometimes I think about it. But I probably won't. I might slow down a bit, but I probably won't. I think most writers just tend to go on to the bitter end. The only writer I can think of off the top of my head who has actually retired is Colin Dexter, who wrote the Inspector Morse series. When he was 70 years old, he just decided that was enough.
Wow.
Well, and then Dorothy L. Sayers did too. Dorothy L. Sayers stopped crime writing after, I think, 11 novels. I'm not quite sure how many. But, you know, she married off Peter Wimsey, and then she did one book after he was married, and then she went on to do other things, which which turned out to be translating Dante's Inferno. Not shabby.
By the way, Peter Wimsey was also a lord, another elite person, but he was a more positive character. In any case, Elizabeth George, I want to thank you very much for being my guest on Work with Marty Nemco.
Thank you. Thank you so much, Marty.
I want to plug a couple things for you. Her latest book is The Punishment She Deserves, just out in paperback, and she will be teaching a master class on the crime novel in Tuscany, Italy, April 21st to April 29th. For information about that, just go to ElizabethGeorge.com, ElizabethGeorge.com. Again, thanks very much, Elizabeth, for being my guest.
You're welcome. Thank you. Bye-bye.
Take care. Bye-bye. Okay, we only have about 9 minutes left, so what do I have for you here? First, I'll invite you to call. If you have a work-related problem, I do what I call workovers here. The advice is free. This is the time, because we only have a few minutes left. The phone number here at Work with Marty Nemco and KELW, 415-841-4134. That's 415-841-4134. One of the websites that I periodically frequent is Quora, and I look for career-related questions that get asked with smart answers. And there was one that just was maybe, I just saw it today, but it was posted maybe a month ago. And the question was on Quora was, everyone seems to want to study machine learning or be a data scientist. Are we headed for a talent bubble? Boy, that resonated with me. And the answer came that was most upvoted. It was upvoted by 2,700 people by Jishar Zia, a PhD in computer vision and machine learning, among other experts. Here was his or her answer. I don't know if Zishan is a man or a woman. Yes, of course we're headed for a talent bubble. Every single one of my friends and acquaintances who has a PhD in something that doesn't lead to a job directly has begun calling himself or herself a data scientist. Obviously, some of them are getting hired. Senior management at all sorts of companies, seeing the media hype, also wants to be in on the action. And so they hire a few scientists without any clear idea of what those folks are supposed to do. Undoubtedly, this is a bubble that will soon burst. So, one of my rules on this show is to never talk something down without proposing an alternative. There's no question that we are continuing to live in an information-centric, computer-centric era. And so while perhaps data science and machine learning and artificial intelligence and deep learning are perhaps oversubscribed these days, but if you are a computer programming-oriented person, there is no question, in my mind at least, that being what is called a full-stack programmer, software engineer, or coder, whatever you want to call yourself, is not going to go away. That is, being able to design both the front end, that is the interface that users use, and the back end, that's the guts behind a piece of software, will be always in demand, especially if you have some business acumen. You need to have a feel, whether it be for-profit or non-profit. The really good software developer has to have a feel for what will bring in the money, whether it be for-profit or non-profit. So that combination, in my judgment, is going to be an area for the computer-centric person that will continue to be viable long, even if the data scientist, artificial intelligence, deep learning, machine learning bubble bursts. Okay. Now, I want to I always like putting a pin in what I think are balloons that are also that deserve bursting. Today's motivational gurus are hell-bent on boosting our self-esteem. We're okay just as we are. We are worthy just by virtue of being human. There is genius in all of us. Ha! Thinking that you're great is a fast way to ensure you stagnate, probably mediocrity. You don't feel there's any need to work on growing if you already think you're just peachy keen fine. A common manifestation of low self-esteem is the imposter syndrome. That is, you have a degree that says you're supposedly qualified as a professional, but deep down you feel you aren't really very qualified as a professional. And that is often an accurate assessment, because training that is done in universities often is longer on theory and on arcana than on practice and the essentials. And that can easily leave you less than competent in the real world. That's why, for example, many law firms provide extensive post-law school training for their newly hired lawyers. The cure for the imposter syndrome is not to dismiss it, mouthing mantras like, I'm good enough, or I will be good enough soon enough. If you fear you're an imposter, the chances are it's true enough that you should force yourself to not suppress that fear, but channel it into working hard at becoming the real deal. For example, you might ask coworkers and clients for feedback. You might find a mentor or two. You might watch top professionals in action and have them watch you. You might study up on important gaps in your expertise. You might get a tutor. You might take a highly rated webinar or a course. Too many self-improvement gurus are selling snake oil, that you can ease your way to success, work less to accomplish more, accept yourself, meditate. But when that fad has faded, and China and India have eaten our lunch and our jobs, we will come to accept again that time-honored truth that success and contentment more likely derive not from being kicked back, but from worrying about not being good enough and thus striving harder. One point, I'm going to go to the phones in just a moment, but my board operator, who is a lawyer, wanted me to clarify an important point. I was talking, Barbara Nemco, who was on the show, was talking about helping to mediate divorces. She made it a point that you cannot be acting as an attorney per se and represent both sides, but you can, under many circumstances, can be a mediator. Anyway, I have a time for a very quick call. Welcome to Work with Marty Nemco. It's your turn on the air. How can I help you?
Hey, Marty, it's Linda Cederborg calling.
Oh, my God, Linda Cederborg. How are you?
Good. I'm just calling to say that I'm downtown Sonoma. I've just gone to an event, and someone told me that you had your show now on Thursday night, and I tuned in on the way home, driving home, and I'm really pleased about hearing that you interviewed Elizabeth George. I think she's wonderful. So
thanks for having her. She's Barbara's favorite author, and so as a favorite, I would have probably wanted to interview Philip Roth if I was going to do a novelist, but she loved Elizabeth George, and I love my wife, as you know, and so that's why I chose Elizabeth George. Anyway, Linda, I need to see you. It's been too long, of course, and I hope the kids are good, and I will thank you for the call.
Yeah, it's wonderful to hear your voice, and I'll talk to you soon.
It's great to hear yours, Linda. Be well. Linda Cederborg is a longtime friend, and her husband, who died prematurely, was also a dear friend, but that's more detail than you want to know. Anyway, that is Work with Marty Nemco for this week. I want to thank my board operator, Joanne Marr, and, of course, all of you for listening and calling in. Please join me again next Thursday at 7 p.m. You can call in for a workover. I'll try to help you with whatever your work problem is. Sorry we didn't have enough time today to do much of that, but we will have more time next week, I promise. Plus, negotiating your compensation in a time of low unemployment. It's at a near 50-year low, and surprisingly, I just read this, according to the Department of Labor, the actual rate of salary increase is higher in the bottom half of the earners, not the top half as that I might have thought. In any event, until then, this is Marty Nemco reminding you that we find comfort among those who agree with us, growth among those who don't.